Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. We bring you Robert Bly this time. Bly is a writer, editor, and activist. Born in rural Minnesota in 1926, he attended Harvard with the writers Donald Hall, Adrian Rich, John Ashbery, John Hawkes, George Plimpton, and Kenneth Koch. In 1956, a Fulbright grant allowed him to live in Norway, where he immersed himself in Norwegian and European literature, which led to his founding of the magazine The 50s upon his return. The magazine, which was later called The 60s and The 70s as the decades passed, focused on publishing work in translation and is largely credited for influencing several generations of writers. In 1966, he co-founded American Writers Against the Vietnam War and led much of the opposition among writers to that war. When he won the National Book Award for his collection The Light Around the Body in 1967, he contributed the prize money to the resistance. In 1990, he published Iron John, a book about men, in which Bly argues that modern men are greatly damaged by an absence of intergenerational male role models and initiation rituals. This work was considered highly controversial and put Bly at the center of the debate around gender identity. All in all, he is the author of more than 30 books and is considered one of America's most revered and controversial poets. Join me for Robert Bly here on Literary Arts, the Archive Project.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me here, and thank you for those lovely introductions. I thought I'd begin with Pablo Neruda. Pablo Neruda wrote all kinds of poems in the course of his life. And then later, after all the political poems, he began to do odes to simple things. Like an ode to a rabbit killed in the road. An ode to suspenders. And he did an ode to my socks, which I loved, and read and translated it. He and I read it together a number of times. So this is an ode to my socks. And you're to think of human beings who are able to love more and more the simple things of the world. Mado Marty bought me a pair of socks, which she knitted herself with her own two shepherd's hands, two socks as soft as rabbits. I slipped my feet into them as though into two cases knitted with threads of twilight and goatskin. Violent socks. My feet were two fish made of wool, two long sharks, sea blue, shot through by one golden thread, two immense blackbirds, two cannons. My feet were honored in this way by these heavenly socks. They were so handsome that for the first time, my feet seemed to me unacceptable. Like two decrepit firemen, firemen unworthy of that woven fire of those glowing socks. Nevertheless, I resisted the sharp temptation to save them somewhere. As students collect fireflies, as learned men collect sacred texts, I resisted the mad impulse to put them into a golden cage and give them each day bird seed and pieces of pink melon. Like explorers in the jungle who hand over the very rare green deer to the spit and eat it with remorse, I pulled on the magnificent socks and then my shoes. And the moral of my ode is this: beauty is twice beauty. And what is good is doubly good when it is a matter of two socks made of wool in winter. So I always begin a poetry reading with some one of these wild characters. And so yesterday, for the first time, I thought, well, one thing I should do in a poetry reading after bringing a European or South American is to bring some younger poet in that isn't that you don't know. And so yesterday, day before yesterday, this book came by a young poet named Jay Leeming called Dynamite on a China Plate. I'm going to read you a couple of poems of his. Ego. Getting rid of your ego is like trying to throw away a garbage can. No one believes you're serious. And the more you yell at the garbage man, the better the neighbors remember your name. Here's the first one he sent to me in the mail a few years ago, and I said, brilliant. It's dedicated to me because I wrote to him. She killed the spider that I've been watching all summer, the one whose gray bed sheets flapped in the corner beside the mailbox. I like coming home to that web spun by the door, to the spider hiding in the corner, and the gnats caught in the web like mail. Now it's autumn and the nights are cold. I value every name in my address book even more. Very touching. All right, let's see. Supermarket historians. All historians should be supermarket cashiers. Imagine what we learn. Your total comes to 1066. That's the year the Normans invaded Britain. Or that'll be 1861, the year the Civil War began. Now all my receipts are beaches where six-year-olds find bullets in the sand. My tomatoes add up to Hiroshima, and if I'd bought one more carton of milk, the cashier would be discussing the Battle of the Bulge and not the Peloponnesian War. But I'm tired of buying soup cans full of burning villages. I'm tired of hearing the shouts of Marines storming beaches in the bread aisle. I want to live in a house carved into a seed inside a watermelon. Look up at the red sky as shopping carts roll through the aisles like distant thunder. This is strange, isn't it? Very strange. This is Jay Leeming. You've got to go out and get this book. It's called Dynamite on the China Plate. This published a few days ago. I picked up a hitchhiker. After a few miles, he tells me that my car has no engine. I pull over and we both get out and look under the hood. He's right. We don't say anything more about it all the way to California. So, that's Jay Leeming. I love the way in America these poets appear out of nowhere, and suddenly they're there. He's a long, skinny guy. And when he walks, he looks like a huge spider going, Anyway, he's a big sweetie. All right, well, I'll have to do some of my own poems, I guess. I'm going to begin with this one called Gratitude to Old Teachers. The older you get, the more you value your teachers. And I remember being, I think it was in California somewhere, and I was telling about, someone said, how did you begin to write poems? And I said, well, in high school, there was a woman who had fantastically beautiful legs, and she'd sit on the radiator and read poems. And I said, it can't be all bad. So I was talking about her, and all of a sudden, a voice in the audience said, I'm here. Unbelievable. I suppose she was only like 18, 19, 20 when she had her first job, and what was I, was 14 or something. That was great. This is called Gratitude to Old Teachers, and I write a lot in a lake up in northern Minnesota, and it was frozen, and I decided to walk across it. When we stride or stroll across the frozen lake, I tried it in the summer, but it didn't work as well. When we stride or stroll across the frozen lake, we place our feet where they have never been. We walk upon the unwalked, but we're uneasy. Who is down there but our old teachers? Water that once could take no human weight, we were students then, holds up our feet and goes on ahead of us for a mile. Beneath us, the teachers, and around us, the stillness. So that's one way I have of thanking Bill. and many of my teachers. Is that clear? Water that once could take no human weight, we were students then, holds up our feet and goes on ahead of us for a mile. Beneath us, the teachers. And around us, the stillness. Well, I remember a poet in Minnesota who said to me, Robert, you only have one good poem. And I said, okay, which one is it? And he told me this, and I said, thank you very much. It's written in that same cabin up by the lake. Thoughts in the cabin. Why do I suddenly feel free of panic? Here a summer afternoon, wind-blown lake, a cabin of strong logs. I can live and die with no more fame. I'd like ground to walk on, a few books, occasionally a storm. I know stories I can tell, and I may or I may not. There's more to learn, the wind and the screen door. The granary of images, the Norwegian lore, the power of schmutt resume, good or evil, success or failure. Expect something else from me. Maybe silence. And don't rule out misdirection, misinformation. I'll read to the end of that. I'm just saying, you know, don't idealize your poets. But, you know, I'm liable to tell you completely wrong things because it felt good at the moment. I know stories I can tell, and I may or I may not. There's more to learn, the wind and the screen door. The granary of images, the Norwegian lore, the power of schmutt resume, good or evil, success or failure. Expect something else from me, maybe silence. And don't rule out misdirection, misinformation. Following Bill, he got up every morning and more or less got up and wrote poems, and I loved that way of doing things. So I decided to do something like that myself. So for a couple of years, I stayed in bed until I'd written my poem for the day. And everyone was quite relieved in a way. I tend to talk a lot at breakfast. And so I would write on what had happened the day before. So one day, Marion Woodman and I were doing a workshop up in Canada, and we went to a party afterwards, and there was a young Russian man there who told his story. And so I decided the next morning I should write down what he said. So I did, and the poem is called The Russian. And the Russian man is talking, not me. The Russians had few doctors on the front line. My father's job was this. After the battle was over, he'd walk among the men hit, sit down and ask, would you like to die on your own in a few hours, or should I finish it? Most said, don't leave me. The two would have a cigarette. He'd take out his small notebook. We had no dog tags, you know. I didn't realize that. The Russians had no dog tags in the Second World War. He'd take out his small notebook and write the man's name down, his wife's, his children, his address, and what he wanted to say. When the cigarette was done, the soldier would turn his head to the side. My father finished off 400 men that way during the war. He never went crazy. They were his people. I thought it was so beautiful he said that. They were his people. So he came to Toronto. My father in the summers would stand on the lawn with a hose, watering the grass that way. It took a long time. He'd talk to the moon, to the wind. I can hear you going, he'd say to the grass. He'd say, we come and go. We're no different from each other. We all are part of something. We have a home. When I was 13, I said, Dad, you know they've invented sprinklers now? That's what, you know, teenagers say that all over the United States. Dad, you know they've invented sprinklers now. He went on watering the grass. This is my life. Just shut up if you don't understand it. So, you know, that's one thing we should be saying to adolescents all over the country. Just shut up if you don't understand it. But everyone's trying to be nice, you know. A good father, you know. He ruins the goddamn car. You don't say anything. It might hurt his feeling. You know what I mean? So, I wrote another one a couple days later about something that happened at this same conference. I was there with Marion Woodman and John Lee, and every time they talked, everyone clapped, and when I talked, nobody clapped. So I thought, well, that's something. So the next morning, I wrote this poem called Wanting More Applause at a Conference. It's something about envy. Now, I won't say I'm envious, but I did have certain moods when I was two. Now, of course, I can't remember any of that. I'm happy if another receives some praise or attention that's really mine. I mean, I talk and the man next to me talks and he gets the applause. Or I am confused and she makes sense. This is hard to bear. I bear it, but it causes trouble inside the den. Is it a mammal problem then? See, it'll lead you to the next part of the thing. Is it a mammal problem then? Six tits are palpable far inside the wiry fur, and I want more than one? Is that it? It is. But such greed is mainly a problem for small mammals, and I am no longer small. Let's call it a mood that we can't remember. Let's call it a habit of opening the mouth when we, who have much, want more, even what belongs to the poor. So, that's really what's happening with the Republicans. Let's call it a habit of opening the mouth when we, who have much, want more. Even what belongs to the poor. Am I saying anything to you? I can't believe what's going on in that respect. All right, only a couple clap, I don't care. Here I am. Oh, it's so strange. I'm still in bed and following Bill Stafford's thing. And so I decided to write some poems, you know, on what is the spirit? What is all that about? It's as if someone else is with me here in this room in which I lie. The longing the ear feels for sound has given me the sweetness that I confuse with her. The joy of being alone, eating the honey of words. The white-walled room, and Stevens, Wallace Stevens, and the sun. This is the joy of the soul that has preserved itself despite fleas and soap in the light-hearted sun. One is not alone when one is alone if she is here. It's a she that no one loves, a she that one loves when one loves what one does love. I'll read the last stanza. One is not alone when one is alone if she is here. And it felt right to put the word she there. Hmm? All over the world, the soul is thought to be feminine. Hmm? One is not alone when one is alone if she is here. It's a she that no one loves. A she that one loves when one loves what one does love. All right, so that's that one. And then I did another little one. I've been thinking about these little adventures in morning longing, these embarkations, excursions in round hide boats on the sea, passing over the beings far below. The deep vowels, perhaps whales. I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree. Do you know that poem by Yeats? I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree in a small cabin built there of clay and the wattles made. Nine bean rows will I have there and a hive with a honey bee and live alone in the bee loud glade. And I shall have some peace there for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings, where midnight's all a glimmer and noon a purple glow and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. When I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core. That's William Butler Yeats. And when he published that poem around 1910, something like that, he got a lot of letters from academics in Ireland who said, I never knew what a vowel was until I heard that poem. The deep vowels, perhaps whales, mourn and sing at their stone table 5 miles down on the ocean floor. They mourn some loss. But the small finny sounds, the ers and ins and ors and ings, mourn as well. We don't know what. Perhaps vowels were all created in a moment of sorrow before creation, a grief they've not been able to sing in this life. I'll read the last stanza. All these little ors and ings, I love all those guys. They all mourn as well. We don't know what. Perhaps vowels were all created in a moment of sorrow before creation, a grief they've not been able to sing in this life. So the last little group in that one, I made 7 of them. I'm just reading you 6 and 7. It's good to remain in bed a while and listen for the A slyly hidden in sequacious. Right? You got to look for these things, man. They hide. It's good to remain in bed a while and listen for the A slyly hidden in sequacious and sent in summer whirl the two ers. I especially love the in hidden in woodbines. Am I like the hog snuffling for truffles, followed by skimpy lords and oversized furs? For this gaiety, do I need forgiveness? Does the lark need forgiveness for its blue eggs? Oh, so it's a bird-like thing then, this warming and hiding of sounds. These are the little low heavens in the nest. Now my chest feathers widen. Now I'm an old hen. Now I'm satisfied. So... So I'm going to read that one again just for fun. But also because I was aware when I got to the lark one that you have to listen what you've written. I'll watch that, see what happens. It's good to remain in bed a while and listen for the A slyly hidden in sequacious and sent in summer world the two ers. I especially love the in hidden in woodbines. Am I like the hog snuffling for truffles, followed by skimpy lords and oversized furs? For this gaiety, do I need forgiveness? Does the lark need forgiveness for its blue eggs? I don't know why I put the lark down, but it leads me to the next thing. So it's a bird-like thing then, this warming and hiding of sounds. They are the little low heavens in the nest. Now my chest feathers widen. Now I'm an old hen. Now I'm satisfied. All right. So I've already said how much I love Bill and how much I've learned from him and what an honor it is to be here with his wife and his children. So here's a little poem of Bill's. You probably know it. There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change. People wonder about what you are pursuing. You have to explain about the thread. But it's hard for other people to see. Tragedies happen, people get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. But you never, ever let go of the thread. Hmm? That's gorgeous. Come on, give me some clapping for that. And that was his way of keeping hold of the thread every morning to get up and do that. You know those stories? Yeah. Other people have different ways. A musician will keep hold of the thread by always playing the guitar, whatever that is, and the sitar, and that's keeping hold of the thread. And so musicians, great musicians, do nothing but play. They don't even care if there's an audience there because they got hold of the thread. And if you pay them, they say, okay, I'll take it. So the other day I wrote a little conversation with Bill. I wept so much when he died. And so this poem I've been working on 55 or 6 months, and I don't know if it's any good, but I'll read it to you anyway. Conversation with Bill Stafford. Well, Bill, what's it like? He says, it's about the same. It's about the same. Wind is still waiting for human beings to catch up. You know what it's like. You wait by the car a while and finally go on alone. And I say, a friend of mine died 2 weeks ago. She wrote back, she said, I'm okay, but the food is terrible. Then I said, you know, there's some lack of information. I don't know what to put, about this or about the other world or about death. There's some lack of information about death, and maybe that's why human beings are all so heroic. And Bill says, Robert, I can see you're starting out on one of your long, reckless roads again. I used to defend you, you know. I don't always agree, but I do like people to be calm. So I said, well, what's it like, Bill? He said, it reminds me of those camping trips we used to take with the kids. You pack up, but no matter how well you do it, you always leave something behind. So I published a book a while ago called The Insanity of Empire, a book against the Iraq War. And I'm going to read a couple of poems out of that book. You know, I was doing a lot of poems in 1968 and 70 and so on, and against the Vietnam War, and I couldn't believe how few voices there were protesting the Iraq War. It's hard to believe. There still aren't many. Do you understand me? It's amazing, the contrast. And we know that to some extent American life has had a huge cultural drop since that time. I mean, the issue of the serious reading done by adults, it drops 10% like every 12 years. And those are well documented, those drops. And of course, I think major thing is television. And if you're allowing your children to watch television more than about 3 hours a day, I just say to you, why don't you just shoot your children, get it over with. If you're so goddamn lazy, you can't even tell stories to the children. Shoot yourself. But we're watching the first country in the history of the world destroyed culturally by television. And so no one knows exactly what to do about it, but we're going to have to face it pretty soon. Because you hear so many lies on television. Think how many lies children take in on a single night of advertisements. They're all lies. And there's, you know, in our hometown there was a young boy, he wasn't too bright, but he had one of the first television sets, and he saw someone harming a person in Chicago or something. He got his rifle and shot the TV set. And that's very smart. Try to do it in front of your children. It's the smoke coming out after you shoot the TV set. You know, that's what'll really impress them. So there's something here about getting used to lies. And it wasn't so bad when it was in the newspapers, because you'd see the crummy advertisements, but there would still be a lot of truth in the middle of the newspaper. But what if the whole thing's lies? And there, in the television, their picture of human relations are all lies. Is that right? You understand me? So how could our children possibly react when Bush says this as well? Is another liar like the rest? I don't know. So this is called Call and Answer, and I think it's the first poem written against the Iraq War, and it wrote in August of 2002. Tell me why it is we don't lift our voices these days and cry over what is happening. Have you noticed the plans are made for Iraq and the ice cap is melting? I say to myself, go on, cry. What's the sense of being an adult and having no voice? Cry out, see who will answer. This is Call and Answer. We'll have to call especially loud to reach our angels who are hard of hearing. They are hiding in the jugs of silence filled during our wars. Remember how Reagan prepared for this by attacking, little funny countries and islands? Why did we do that? What were all those wars about? We'll have to call especially loud to reach our angels who are hard of hearing. They are hiding in the jugs of silence filled during our wars. Have we agreed to so many wars that we can't escape from silence? If we don't lift our voices, we allow others who are ourselves to rob the house. And to me, that refers a little bit to television, too, that people, we allow others come in the television set and rob our houses. You know what I mean? It's just like letting people come in and steal things. They steal your kids, steal this, steal that. We don't do anything when people rob our houses. So when Bush begins to rob our house, we say, oh, well, I don't know. How come we've listened to the great criers, Neruda, Ekmatova, Thoreau, Frederick Douglass, and now we're silent as sparrows in the little bushes? It's a bad pun, but I left it in. How come we've listened to the great criers, Neruda, Anna Akhmatova, Thoreau, Frederick Douglass, and now we're silent as sparrows in the little bushes? Last stanza. Some masters say our life only lasts 7 days. Where are we in the week? Is it Thursday yet? Hurry, cry now. Soon Sunday night will come. And Sunday night came when they bombed Iraq. I have to call that Sunday night. All right, here's another one called Advice from the Geese. Hurry, the world is not going to get better. Do what you want to do now. The prologue is over. Soon actors will come on stage carrying the coffin. I don't want to frighten you, but not a stitch can be taken on your quilt unless you study. The geese will tell you a lot of crying goes on before dawn comes. Do you have a friend who has studied prisons? Does a friend say, I love the 12 houses? The word houses suggests prison all by itself. So much suffering goes on among prisoners. There's so much grief in the cells. That's a great thing about English, the cells in prisons is the same word as the cells in your own body. So much suffering goes on among prisoners, there's so much grief in the cells. So many bolts of lightning keep coming down from the unborn. Please don't expect that the next president will be better than this one. 4 o'clock in the morning is the time to read Basilides. Basilides is an old Gnostic writer who said, look, this is a dark planet. Get it through your head. Please don't expect that the next president will be better than this one. 4 o'clock in the morning is the time to read Basilides. Last stanza. Every seed spends many nights in the earth. Give up the idea that the world will get better by itself. You will not be forgiven if you refuse to study. And I have to say that to myself. You will not be forgiven if you refuse to study. All right, I'm trying to depress you. How am I doing? So I'm going to read a different sort of a poem now for a bit. I started working on the ghazals or the ghazals, and that's the oldest poetic form in the Muslim culture, which is a very great culture, by the way, very, very great. And it started in the 10th century as a love poem in Arabic, and then gradually all of the various members of the Islamic culture began to write in that form. And it has three characteristics which I will mention. First of all, you're given 36 syllables to say what you have to say, and then you have to shut up. That is to say, you have 36 syllables. They use two 18-syllable lines, but in English you can't continue a line over 15 syllables or so. So I use three 16-syllable lines. You got these syllables to say what you have to say, and then you have to change the subject. Well, that's interesting, because he changes the subject once, he changes it the second time, and people in the audience in the Muslim country say, "What the hell is going on? What is this poem about?" You understand me, do you? At the same time, you're saved long, long speeches by Robert Frost. I mean, you know, when he gets started on walls, don't try to stop him. He's a very great poet. I love him, but he... Anyway, so that's one characteristic, that you change the subject after 36 syllables. Second thing is that you don't rhyme, but the same word ends every stanza. The same word or group of words ends every stanza. That's very interesting, because just like you long for a rhyme, you begin to long to see how that word's going to come back. You understand me? That's a lot of the fun that they have in listening to the ghazals. And the third one is that in the last stanza you mention your own name. And part of that is done, I think, because the Muslim world is so huge that someone can do a poem in Afghanistan and then 3 weeks later it's recited in a cafe in Cairo. And they don't publish, they memorize. So therefore the only way you can identify it as your poem is to put your name in the end. And that's why it's called Rumi. Rumi is not his name. Rumi means someone born in the province of Rum. And Hafez, not his name. Hafez means someone who has memorized the entire Quran. And apparently that's how Hafez made a living, by reciting the Quran. And I don't always do the third one, and I don't always do the second one, but, you know, I'm just a beginner, you know. This is called Listening to Shahram Nazari. He's a very great Iranian singer. And he gave a concert in San Francisco about 10 days ago, Shahram Nazari. And there's a lot of connection between Iranian music and Mongolian music. You can hear horses in it all the time. So I mentioned that. Listening to Shahram Nazari. I know the horses keep galloping for miles. And I know the ants keep lifting their feelers to heaven and planning new triumphs, but it's already too late. When Nazari sings, I don't care if the second Adam comes down or not. I don't care if my words get you to cry or not. It's already too late. Got to repeat that with me. Come on. It's already too late. The smell of coffee spreads out from the fire, and the wild-haired old women sing over the coffin. Go on complaining and crying. It's already too late. I know sweet vowels and inescapable rhythms. And I always send my poems to Don Hall, and he said, "What is an inescapable rhythm?" I said, "Shut up." I know sweet vowels and inescapable rhythms, and I know how sweet it is when a young woman is here and the old men think of God. But it's already too late. My tongue never becomes bitter because my mouth keeps holding the grief pipe between my teeth. That's something that the Muslims talk about a lot. Always having grief will protect you from being bitter. And I think it's great. It's great. But we're scared of everything that doesn't rhyme or something. I don't know. We always want happy singers. They say, just shoot the happy singers. Let's get rid of them. My tongue never becomes bitter because my mouth always keeps holding the grief pipe between my teeth. Go on and conquer bitterness. It's already too late. Come on, you're not doing it. It's already too late. It's already too late. And I don't know what that phrase means. Sometimes it feels very happy to me. It's already too late. And forget it. She's already married. What are you going to do? You know. (Clears throat) All right, so I'll give you one that uses the same word at the end of the sentence. The Muslims say something that's very interesting. They say, God has existence, and we have non-existence. And there's something touching about that. Luckily, we got something. We got non-existence. Could have been worse, I think. The bridegroom wanted to reach the Norwegian church, but the roads were made impassable by huge snows. We are each the bridegroom longing for existence. Marriage brings the moth close to the candle flame. This is one of the oldest metaphors in the whole world. With their frail wings, men and women are constantly flying into the fire of existence. Shall I read that to you again? Marriage brings the moth close to the candle flame. With their frail wings, men and women are constantly flying into the fire of existence. Some say that each drop of groundwater in Kansas, did I change the subject? Did you hear it? Some say that each drop of groundwater in Kansas knows about the ocean. How can this be? Every drop of water longs, like us, for existence. Abu Sayyid was an old Muslim suffering man. He was out in the wilderness and he suffered there with very little food and everything for 20 years. And he had an old dragon out there he talked to once in a while. And when he came back to town, then he became a very happy person and started a whole bunch of songs and all that. 20 years later, he went back out to where he'd been and he met the old dragon again. And this is what happened. Abu Sayyid fasted in the desert for 20 years. Later, when he came back, his dragon friend wept. Your suffering gave me a hint of existence. I never thought about that. The dragons don't know anything about things. Dragon said, your suffering gave me a hint of existence. And this is my wife playing the Bach on the piano. When the pianist's fingers strike all the notes in the 10th prelude, it's clear that Bach's soul has been leaping about like a hare in the field of existence. Isn't that right? When the pianist's fingers strike all the notes in the 10th prelude, it's clear Bach's soul has been leaping about like a hare in the field of existence. Robert, you're close to joy, but not quite there. Did you see how I finally brought my name in? It's kind of embarrassing, you know, but... Robert, you're close to joy, but not quite there. You're a hunchback standing in an Italian square, looking in at the festival of existence. The last line is actually a memory of Leopardi, who has left notes that he did that. He had a hunchback and he didn't feel that he could appear there and he'd stand in little side alleys and see what was happening. This is the poem that they're going to put, part of it they're going to put on the buses. So I'll read you that. I've never read this one aloud before. No one has ever admired it before. It's called Listening to Old Music, and there's a very old instrument that the Indians have called the Rudra Veena. And I was listening to that. I don't know what would bring me closer to you. Maybe slowing down this music. Maybe waking in the middle of the night. Maybe diving for the bottom. Second stanza. Maybe silence. The speed of the soul leaping over fences brings the toe forward. At other times, a book resting on my chest takes me backward into my mother's arms. I think those are the two that they're going to put on the buses. And people look at them and say, what the hell is this? So it's got a few more stanzas, and I'll read them. The ache in the fold of my arm must be the old sadness that the newborn feels when he senses that his father has come to claim him for this world. The ache in the fold of my arm must be the old sadness that the newborn feels when he senses that his father has come to claim him for this world. Don't ask me whether to take Plato's side or Freud's. That's what you can change the subject in the middle, right? I say, don't ask me whether to take Plato's side or Freud's. What's that got to do with the rest? You figure it out. Don't ask me whether to take Plato's side or Freud's. Just come over here and help me burn my books so we can move to Argentina. You know, you get too many books eventually. All right, the drum insists that the night we die will be a long night. The Red Ravina goes on insisting that there's not enough suffering. The drum insists that the night we die will be a long night. The Red Ravina goes on insisting there's not enough suffering. Go on, Red Ravina, go on growling about God. I am rubbing my big face against my little face like a blackbird flying swiftly through the leaves. It doesn't make any sense, but it's a lot of fun to put it down. I'm rubbing my big face against my little face like a blackbird flying swiftly through the leaves. Yeah, okay, good. That's the end of that one. Now, I've got four more I want to read to you. Is that too much? Will that be okay for you? Four. All right, now I did existence, the word existence, now I'll do one non-existence. It's called eating blackberry jam. When I hear that we all belong to non-existence, I drop my eyes, but then I raise them out of love for the little creatures of non-existence. Some say that perch become like each other to keep the shark from zeroing in, but staying alive doesn't mean they are free from non-existence. The cries of the infant barn swallows, rising ingeniously. No, the cries of the infant barn swallows, rising from the mud nests, fastened ingeniously to the rafters. This is a farm boy's poem. The cries of the infant barn swallows, rising from the mud nests, ingeniously to the rafters, taught me to love the skinny birds of non-existence. Taoists, with their thin beards, fishing all day with a straight hook. You know, they do that. They do that. Taoists with their thin beards, fishing all day with a straight hook, tell us they have learned not to expect a whole lot from non-existence. And here's the first stanza that I wrote accidentally, and then I had to go back and do five more. Blackberries have so many faces that their jam is a kind of thickening of nothing. Each of us loves to eat the thick syrup of non-existence. Blackberries have so many faces that their jam is a kind of thickening of nothing. Each of us loves to eat the thick syrup of nothing. I have to stick up for non-existence, isn't that right? The last stanza. Now, in the original form, it can go from five stanzas on to 28. But I always do six because I'm just a beginner. When each stanza closes with the same word, I'm glad. A friend says, if you're proud of that, you must be one of the secretaries of non-existence. All right, I did my first book was called The Night Abraham Called of the Stars, which has 48 of these, and then the new book, My Sentence for 1,000 Years of Joy, is another 48. So I'm going to read this one that I liked in this book. And I was trying to think, what's the most beautiful word in the English language? I thought maybe it's listening. Listening. The goose cries and there's no way to save her. So many sheeps come from the nest by the river. If God doesn't listen, why are we listening? Very deep water covers most of the globe. Whenever I see it, I think of St. John. There's no remedy for deep water but listening. Very deep water covers most of the globe. Whenever I see it, I think of St. John. There's no remedy for deep water but listening. The king and queen already know about love. They search for each other through the whole deck. While we play our hands, they are listening. The day we die, we each be like a fish abruptly jerked out of the water. For him is the end of all listening. See how beautiful it is when you can change a subject like that?
That was Robert Bly. He spoke as part of Poetry Downtown in 2006. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project, a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talk in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Crystal Ligori produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community without whom this show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.